From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection for this half hour was made in March of 2014. Longtime local broadcaster Rich Funke had retired, and he decided he couldn't stay retired for long. He announced a run for the state Senate last March, challenging Democratic incumbent Ted O'Brien. Rich Funke called for smaller and smarter government, and he easily won election in November, picking up 56% of the vote. Now the hard work begins of working on that budget and tackling state issues. And for the first time, we welcome Rich Funke to Connections. And Senator, it is great to have you on the program. Thanks for being here.
Good to see you.
Well, interesting time to come into state office, isn't it?
There's never a dull moment.
Yeah,
Albany,
Sheldon Silver is going to be done with the speakership as of Monday, and we know that the Democrats are jockeying. That's the other side of the chamber. But I know you know Joe Morelli and have known him over the years. And part of the question emerging in Albany is, does upstate get a real crack at this? Are you looking at that saying, that's not my chamber, I don't really care what happens, it's not even my party, or would you like to see Joe Morelli in that post?
Well, I certainly care what happens. It is not my chamber, as you point out, but, you know, Joe Morelli is a constituent of mine, so I'm always inclined to want to, you know, support my constituents. So is Brian Kolb, for that matter. But obviously it's not going to be in the cards for Brian Kolb. But for Joe Morelli, I think he's worked very hard down there. I think what's going to be, if Joe is not the speaker, I certainly hope that he will remain Senate Majority Leader, and he'll be the interim speaker, of course, coming up. But, you know, to the extent that Joe is able to work with upstate Republicans, and he has in the past, I think that's very important. It's going to be very important for our community.
There is a sense in that assembly, you've heard some members of the New York City delegation saying, hey, this is a New York City post. I've talked to your colleague Joe Robach over the years, and Joe, I think with some seriousness, floats this notion of separating the state. And he says, look, they think that they own this state. Do you feel that way already in the Senate? Do you feel there's a divide between upstate and downstate?
I don't feel that way in the Senate Republican Conference. I think we all work together. I think everybody views one another as teammates. That you're on the same page as much as you can be. Are there issues that divide us? Certainly. You know, New York City wants its fair share. Upstate wants its fair share. And when it gets down to legislation, we have to hammer that out. But, you know, as far as the assembly is concerned, it is a Democratic-dominated body, obviously, and New York City dominates that. So back to Joe Morelli, his opportunity, his chance of becoming speaker. I think it'll be very difficult for him. I think probably Carl Heastie, when all is said and done, you know, if I'm to make a prediction, would be the first African-American speaker of the assembly. But we'll see what happens when all of that shakes out. But certainly I'm supportive of Joe Morelli and what he's done for upstate, and I certainly look forward to working with him. And on the Senate Republican side, yeah, you talk about a divide. Yeah, you know, there's a divide between upstate and downstate, but it's more with the Senate Democrats than it is with the Senate Republicans.
We're talking to Rich Funke, state senator, who the Republicans chose to deliver the response to Governor Cuomo's State of the State address. And, Rich, you took the opportunity to focus both on taxes and the need for the private sector to be the engine that really creates jobs. Let's listen to a portion of Rich Funke responding to the governor's State of the State address.
Together, we have the power to put New Yorkers on a better path for the future. It starts with getting government out of the way so the private sector can create new, high-paying jobs and give working people the power to live out their destiny right here in New York.
At the same time that was happening, the governor was talking about his upstate economic development plan, potentially handing out pots of $500 million. And, Rich, I go back to election night when we were talking, a lot of people talked about this Buffalo Billion. Mm-hmm. And Rich Funke on election night wanted to make a statement about how Rochesterians often tend to feel about the Buffalo Billion. Let's listen to Rich back in November on election night on the Buffalo Billion.
It'll be about getting our fair share of school aid and economic development aid. If Buffalo got $1 billion, by God, we better be next in line.
That was one of the biggest cheers of the night you got there. But square this up for me. How can you say Rochester needs $1 billion to make it fair and then say it's got to be the private sector that creates jobs? It feels to me that there's a dissonance between those two statements.
Well, I mean, you know, to the extent that government, it's our tax dollars at work. If they're going to be distributed, then they ought to come back to us, Evan. That's all I'm saying. You know, the governor pledged $1 billion to Buffalo. He wants us to compete for the billion and a half. What I'm saying is, at the end of the day, it's your money. To have the governor stand up there during his State of the State address and say, if I just gave you the money, well, it's our money. You know, it's going to be distributed one way or the other. We should be able to take advantage of that. The notion of competing for those dollars did not sit well with me. It hasn't sat well with a number of people. Will we compete? You bet we'll compete. We're accustomed to competing in this community. And so, you know, we'll do that. But, for example, to have Albany in the mix with this group, which Albany has received billions of dollars, not a billion, like billions of dollars for their nanotech industry down there. I just think that, does government create jobs? No, it shouldn't. The private sector should create jobs. But if those tax dollars are available and allow the public or the private sector to move forward, then we ought to be in line for that money.
Your colleague Bill Nogé was on this program, an assemblyman, Republican assemblyman, a couple of weeks ago, and he rejects the premise that the Buffalo Billion is even working. And so I'd like to hear the comments from Bill Nogé on the Buffalo Billion, and then we'll see if Rich agrees here. I know the phone's ringing. Poor Val back behind the glass. The engineer always has the hardest job, and Rich Funky knows this better than anybody. Before I hear Bill's comments, is the Buffalo Billion working? I don't know how much time you spend in Buffalo. I don't spend a whole lot of time there, but the question is the premise accepted that it's working?
As far as they're concerned, it's working. If you talk to the county executive and talk to the mayor of Buffalo, things are working, but... you know, I think the harborfront development, I think people see that, and I think that's exciting stuff that's happening downtown in Buffalo. So I think, obviously, that's working. The solar industry is a very big deal up in Buffalo, and things are happening there, and jobs are being created up there. So I think they believe that it's working. I don't know how it can't work if you're able to invest those kind of dollars in a community and you're able to create jobs, and I think they've been able to do that to some extent. You know, if you talk to officials up there, and like you, I haven't spent a whole lot of time up there, but I think they believe it's working.
Okay, and so
there's an energy in Buffalo now that hasn't existed in the last couple of years. Let's be honest about that. You know, I'd like to see that same kind of energy developed in our community.
Okay, and so is there this notion that do you think, though, as a senator who ran on this idea of lower taxes, more efficient, smaller, smarter government? And I understand the equality thing. I mean, Buffalo for years has gotten more state aid. We see that every year. But is there a sense that the argument should be that $1 billion should never have been spent? We don't need $1 billion here. The government shouldn't be handing out $1 billion anyway, and take the reins off the private sector, let them do it.
Well, there's certainly an argument for that. I'm not going to dispute that. So then we could reduce taxes for everybody, couldn't we?
But you're not making that argument, are you?
I'm not making that argument right now. I mean, the governor is into economic development. We have to do something to spur the economy in our state. We have to do something here to create jobs. We have to do something here to make certain that people aren't leaving our community and businesses aren't leaving our community for other states.
When it comes to public-private partnerships,
more revenue here.
Yeah, well, certainly. And public-private partnerships seem to be the way of the future. Mark Johns told us that's really the way government is working in this state. Mm-hmm. Is that part of the premise as well, that, you know, this is the reality on the ground and we've got to make that work, public-private partnerships, Rich?
You know, I'm just getting my arms around this stuff right mm-hmm. now, to be honest with you, Evan, but that appears to be, you know, what has been happening, and that appears to be what, you know, the formula is going forward here. It's the governor's formula for sure. And, you know, if tax dollars are out there, it's our money. Let's get it back.
Did the governor make a mistake in banning fracking, or do you support the decision?
I didn't think fracking was right for the 55th district. But having said that, I felt that it was probably going to happen in the southern tier, and I think that local communities should have the right to determine their own fate.
So home rule seemed, what surprised me about that was when the court ruled last year that home rule was legally upheld, essentially saying if individual towns want to ban it, they can, and if individual towns don't, they don't have to.
Right.
I thought the governor had an opening to say, if you want fracking, you can have it, and if you don't, you've got to ban it. Did you expect that to be the governor's play as well?
I think we sort of expected that there would be a trial circumstance in the southern tier, which so desperately needs jobs and needs development. So I think all of us were a little bit surprised that didn't happen, particularly coupled with the casino circumstance there that the Southern tier got left out of the mix completely. You know, I would have favored, I think, a home rule circumstance. And again, I don't feel it's right for a district that's pretty much defined by water from Lake Ontario all the way down to Naples in the 55th district. But for other parts of the state where, you know, it's so desperately, you know, revitalization is so desperately needed, I thought that there might be an opening there. And now I'm seeing that they, you know, environmental conservation may consider revisiting it somewhere down the road. So we'll see what happens.
We're talking to State Senator Rich Funke, freshman senator, and recently delivered the response for the Republicans to the governor's State of the State address. Only complaint I saw to your performance was from Mr. Nojay, who said you should have mentioned the SAFE Act, that was a big hot-button issue in this state, especially among conservative voters, that they still want to see momentum turn back to repealing it. Did you leave it out for a reason? Do you think it's sort of a non-starter right now? Or are you moving on, or do you still does that still an issue that's fresh with you?
Well, that was, first of all, I was doing a response for the conference.
Absolutely.
From, responding to the governor. He didn't mention the SAFE Act either, nor would you expect him to.
No.
I was proud to deliver on two promises that I made during this course of the campaign in the first week that I was there. Number one was to sign on to repeal the SAFE Act, and number two was to pass the women's equality agenda. So nothing has changed with me with regard to the SAFE Act. I think it was done poorly. In the first place, I think it should be repealed, and I'll stand with that.
Okay. When it comes to the women's equality agenda, update our listeners on where that legislation stands in terms of the Senate and then the overall legislature.
Well, in terms of the Senate approved the 8 points again our very first day, and we have sent that on to the Assembly. And again, this is legislation that provides for equal pay for equal work, tougher provisions against human trafficking and sexual harassment in the workplace, domestic violence, issues of that nature. So it'll be up to the Assembly now to decide what it wants to do. A Democratic Assemblywoman, Amy Paulin, is among the Democrats in the Assembly now who believe that it should be the Senate version should be passed and sent to the governor. So we're just awaiting Assembly action on that.
Yeah, and our listeners may be familiar with the fact that this has become sort of an annual dance that results in very little every year when it comes to these issues, that there were at one point 10 points. And are there 9 now, Rich? The Senate passed 8, the exception being the governor calling for
one of them was coupled with another, so it became a technical issue.
Gotcha. And so the Senate has been passing the points one by one, essentially saying, let's look at each point individually. Let's talk about them and let's decide whether we want to pass them or not. The Assembly has tried to bring them all together in one package because their concern, as Democrats explain it to me, is that if the protection of reproductive rights is not included, that it will never be included. Democrats tell me that their concern is they look around the United States, 22 states in the last 2 years have passed new restrictions on reproductive rights and abortion. They don't want New York to go down that road. They don't want to expand abortion. They want to leave it where it is and protect it. So do you disagree with their perception of this, Rich? I mean, they're saying we don't need to expand it. We want to protect it from encroachment, whether it's a state legislature that wants to come in or elsewhere. What do you think?
Legal scholars disagree on what the 10th point means. To us, it means expanding it. Democratic Senator Dianne Savino, I think, said it best a couple of weeks ago. She said, there are women in this state who are not getting equal pay for equal work right now. There are people who are being abused in the workplace. There's human trafficking going on in this state. And in every one of those circumstances, all of those people can get a safe legal abortion in the state of New York right now.
And that's Democratic Senator Dianne Savino, and your reaction to that was exactly right?
Exactly right. Exactly right. So, the state law in the state of New York preceded Roe v. Wade. So, I think, again, legal scholars disagree in terms of what this would mean, but in my way of thinking, look, let's take up this issue separately. Let's see where it goes. Let's get these other eight laws, for heaven's sakes, that have affected women in this state for far too long, years now. Let's get them passed. Let's get them approved. Let's get it done.
You feel like this is being politicized?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
And when it comes to restriction, again, what Rich is saying, what Senator Funk is saying, is their view is that that 10th point on the women's equality agenda would allow for an expansion of abortion rights. I know that Democrats have said that's not correct, but again, there's some disagreement there. Setting that aside, for the Democrats who say, okay, we want to leave them in place, but we don't want them encroached, would you favor any restriction on reproductive rights right now? Would you favor any other laws that would restrict?
Laws are on the books. Not going there. Laws are on the books in the state of New York. Anybody who suggests otherwise that the Republican conference or anybody in the state of New York is looking to somehow overturn those laws that are on the books in the state of New York is being disingenuous about it. And that's a fact. Nothing, it could be farther from the truth there.
Talking to State Senator Rich Funke for a few more minutes and squeezing in a half hour for us on his busy schedule. Let's grab a call. This is Keith in Brighton. Go ahead, Keith.
Evan, I appreciate these types of show. And Richard, thanks for taking the time out. A couple of things before any, again, I appreciate you being there, but this is all directed to all politicians. Before the politicians start running around saying we need a casino here and we need a casino here, blah, 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 they should look at the study done by CGR several years ago, and especially in reference to the one in Niagara Falls, Canada, because it just didn't pan out as they said it would, because if you just look around where the casino is, you'll see all the empty storefronts. But the comment about, and every politician does it, you got to lower taxes to create jobs. Lowering the taxes helps the bottom line of the owners of the company and the stockholders. And I'll give you a best example. Scott Conjol over in West Irondequoit. He's got all these tax things. He didn't create one freaking job. What businesses need are customers. I could pay no taxes next year on the business I own, all right? But if I don't have any customers, it doesn't matter. Businesses need customers. They don't need lower taxes. Because how can you create jobs if you have no customers?
All right, Keith. Thanks for the call. Let me let the senator jump in. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, lower property taxes would mean more money to spend as a customer, too. Lower property taxes, and we're talking about property taxes here, I mean, for individuals and for everybody, for that matter, would allow people to stay in this state and create the revenue stream that Keith would like to see. More customers, more people coming back to New York. We're losing population, you know, and we need people to stay here. And if you talk to people, you know, the biggest reason why they won't stay here is because their property taxes are too high, or they can't get a job, or they're senior citizens and they're moving because they don't want to afford the taxes any longer. So, you know, in many ways, you know, your kids graduate from college, they can't get a job here. They're going to move to North Carolina. They're going to go somewhere else. We're splitting families apart in this state. We need to get our arms around the whole thing and try to create an environment here that's business friendly, that's family friendly, and so that people stay here, work here, live here, shop here, and earn a living here.
Maybe even retire here?
Maybe even retire here.
And to be clear, the senator has not defended, to my knowledge, Scott Conjol and that development out of
Heavens, no.
Okay. So Keith was bringing it up as a point to make, but not to say that Rich had supported. I wanted to make
no,
it.
No, I mean—
Certainly not.
Absolutely not.
Dave writes to us, in terms of regulations, what exactly does getting government out of the way mean? What New York regulations specifically to get rid of?
Well, I mean, there's 750,000 regulations on the books. Senator Pat Gallivan identified 2,200 of them last year and presented them to the governor for review. We're going through some of those right now, and you know, we'll talk about that when the you know, a little bit later on, but there are some that have, you know, one, for example, that has just passed most recently was a requirement that you had to show paperwork telling an employee what they made every week, every year, four times a year, something like that. I mean, it was just owner's paperwork that meant nothing. You get your paycheck at the end of the year and you, or at the end of the week or every 2 weeks, and you see what you've earned and so on. There was additional paperwork that was required of companies to tell them again what they earned. That was just one of those silly little regulations that how it got in there, nobody seems to know. But it cost companies a lot of money, and it was one regulation that was done away with. But, I mean, there are a lot of them on the books that we have to take a look at day in and day out, and people are working on that right now.
And when it comes to lowering taxes, especially lowering property taxes, the first question some people have is, you know, can you make up that revenue stream? Does the government cut spending? I mean, again, as we talked about this half hour, you're not calling on the governor to rescind that $1.5 billion pot of money for upstate, and I know that comes out of the bank settlements, et cetera. But, you know, that $5.1 billion in bank settlements could have gone to tax relief immediately.
Or
infrastructure, as you said. But when
that's
it comes
where
to
it should go.
Okay, so when it comes to property tax cutting, where do we make up the revenue? Where specifically can we find ways to say, hey, we don't have to spend this, that does not have to be spent, et cetera?
Well, I mean, you create jobs and you create better paying jobs and you make it up through income tax. You create a circumstance where businesses are relocating in New York State. More businesses are coming back here and creating those opportunities. That's where the revenue stream hopefully would be made up. Is through employment.
Is that sort of classic supply side economics?
I guess so.
Yeah. Rich Funke, a state senator. And Rich, for those who have supported you in this campaign, they see you in a different way now. You're a state senator. I don't know if you ever thought you would be in your broadcasting career. You retired and you spent a year in retirement. What convinced you that you really wanted this job? Was there a moment or a day where you thought?
I mean, you spend your lifetime in broadcasting, dabbling in issues, looking at both sides of an issue and trying to write a story about it and trying to be fair and balanced and down the middle on it and trying to look at all sides and everything like that. So I think there's a certain skill set there that is transferable into the public arena. And you spend a lot of time in public service. And I view public office as public service. That's exactly what it is. So you sit on the sidelines and you take a look and you don't like the direction of the state of New York is going. And you see circumstances, like the corruption that has occurred in Albany most recently. And you say, good Lord, we can do better than this. You look at what's going on a national level and you say, look, you've got two options in life. Either you can sit on the sidelines or you can get in the game. Not so much for sitting on the sidelines. And at 66 years old tomorrow, I said, if I can do anything, I want to stand up for my community, stand up for the people that I care about and have been good to me, and do what I can to make things better. If that means helping the economy get better in upstate New York, if it means being a champion for our region, if it means going down to Albany and saying, look, term limits are a better way to go, for our community, for this legislature, I want to do that. I'm willing to be that voice. I'm willing to go fight for our community. And having seen what's happened in other communities around the state and to see that Rochester, which has been in a 10-year decline, downsizing circumstance, I remember the days of Kodak and Bausch & Lomb and Xerox where everybody was riding high and everybody was fat and happy. And to see what's happened here in the last 10, 15 years has been difficult for me to watch. And it's been difficult for me to watch, particularly when, it doesn't seem like everybody has been on the same page. If I can be the person that tries to get everybody on the same page, whether it's the delegation, whether it's the city and the county, whether it's Albany, keeping an eye toward Rochester for once, that's what I want to do. We've got a lot of problems. We've got a lot of issues here. Poverty. I mean, poverty is not just a city issue. It's everybody's issue here. All your pride, all your energy emanates from the city. You don't want to leave Rochester when you used to say, hey, where are you from? I'm from Rochester. Oh, Kodak. Yeah, that was great. Well, now you don't want to go somewhere and have somebody say, oh, yeah, you're the third poorest city in America, aren't you? I mean, does anybody want that? So this is a problem we all have to get our arms around, that we all have to face and deal with day in and day out. And that's all I care about. I care about the people here and trying to make things better. And that's what we'll try to do.
A couple more quick questions, and Rich has got to go. Very few people have covered the Buffalo Bills like you have over the year, the years. I imagine the Pegula's ownership was exciting for a lot of people, but in the next 5 years, there's going to, actually sooner than that, there will be the question on a stadium. Would you support any state tax dollars helping build a new stadium in Buffalo?
I would not, but I'd have to discuss that with a whole lot of people. I'd say this. I've said this before. Before we discuss spending a nickel on a new stadium, we need to have some public hearings to let the public weigh in on that. It's your money. You have to decide.
And one more quick phone call, and this is Chad and Henrietta, and the last call for Rich Funke. Go ahead, Chad.
I'm sorry, maybe you're going to be on the topic, but in terms of reducing taxes, two-thirds of my real estate tax bill is related to schools. So how would one, if you reduce your school tax bill, or eliminate it, how do you fund schools? And the second thing is that I used to do economic development years ago for a local municipality, and we always felt that if real estate taxes make the difference between an organization being a successful entity or an unsuccessful entity, it wasn't much of an enterprise. So I'll take my answer off the air.
Chad, thanks for the call. Go ahead, Rich.
School taxes are definitely an issue, definitely a problem. Real estate taxes are definitely a problem, but you're right. I mean, you know, we have to cut spending at some point. We have to figure out a way to reduce our costs here in New York State. The fact of the matter is our taxes are too high because we spend too much. And so we have to get our arms around that, and we have to figure out, you know, what are people willing to live without? You know, we have a Medicaid bill in the state of New York that's $1 billion a week. So what are you willing to do without? So it's a difficult circumstance.
And schools have to make that choice too?
And schools, yeah, everybody has to make that choice. You know, as far as schools are concerned, gap elimination adjustment is going to be another issue that we're going to, you know, tackle here in the next couple of days. We have to get rid of gap elimination adjustments so that schools are funded properly, so that they are able to do the things that they need to do and be able to form the budgets that they need to form. The gap elimination adjustment was a huge impact in West Irondequoit last year, as you know. So that's something that we're going to be pressing hard to eliminate in the budget this year so that schools are fully funded. So, you know, that'll be an important thing coming up.
Open door whenever you want to come back. And it's great to see you. And it's nice to catch up with you. Rich Funke is state senator, very busy and very gracious to fit some time for us and WXXI listeners into his schedule. Thank
you. Yeah, I would just like to tell everybody, please don't hesitate to call us with your ideas, with your thoughts. You know, if we're going to get anything done in this state, we have to work together to get it done. Republicans, Democrats, independents, conservatives. Let's get together and figure this thing out.
Rich Funke, thanks for taking the time, sir.
You bet.
All right, we'll talk to him again. Short break. We're coming back in a conversation with a longtime journalist Soledad O'Brien next on Connections. Welcome back to Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. It's rare to be in two places at the same time, but right now Soledad O'Brien is doing that. She is in Rochester at RIT specifically. We're going to hear about that in just a second, and you're about to hear her interview with my colleague Michelle Faust, who is in studio now. Hello, Michelle.
Hi.
Soledad O'Brien's in town for what today?
That's right. So RIT, as we speak, they're having a celebration and a commemoration of Martin Luther King Jr.'s birthday, and African American History Month is just around the corner. And so what they're having is an event called Expressions of King's Legacy. In advance of this, I spoke with Soledad O'Brien. She is their keynote speaker, who's speaking right now.
Right now.
And she's talking about diversity on TV, behind the scenes, and in our lives. So she's talking about diversity as it plays out in many different ways and reflecting on King's legacy. Most people know Soledad O'Brien from Black in America, Latino in America, and series of documentaries that she's done. But she's also done some documentaries on King's life. So that's...
A lot of people might know her from her work on CNN for years as well.
True.
And in fact, you know, if we could, I'm just going to play a short clip because, so, interestingly enough, in the 2012 election cycle, Soledad O'Brien became kind of a Rorschach test for your political preferences because Democrats said she was finally getting tough on people. Republicans said that she was just a hack from from the left. I don't think either was totally fair. Well, I think that she was trying to be firm, understanding the issues, and unafraid to question. Here's a clip of Soledad O'Brien on CNN with John Sununu, former New Hampshire governor who was chairing the Romney campaign there. He had just picked Paul Ryan, and Soledad O'Brien said, so it looks like his long-praised Ryan budget plan is going to be adopted by the Romney campaign. Let's listen.
Let's talk about what everybody's talking about now, which is the Ryan budget and the Ryan Medicare plan. You told Wolf yesterday, I believe, hey, listen, Ryan is number two on the ticket. It's really all about the Romney plan.
It is. The nominee is Mitt Romney. Paul Ryan joins Mitt Romney. The budget plan, the approach on Medicare and all that, is going to be the Romney plan.
But isn't the Ryan plan the Romney plan? I mean, here's what Mitt Romney...
No, it isn't.
Well, let me just read you a quote.
No, it...
Hang on.
But it isn't.
Well, let me just
read you... You guys keep wanting to say it, and I'm telling you it's not.
Then let me read you a quote from Mitt Romney. This is from Ryan Liz's article in The New Yorker, which was about 2 weeks ago. He said this on March 20th in Chicago. I'm very supportive of the Ryan budget plan. He said, I think it would be marvelous if the Senate were to pick up Paul Ryan's budget and adopt it and pass it along to the president. That sounds like a lot of support. Am I wrong?
It's support for the concepts that are in the Ryan plan, but Mitt Romney for 6 months has had on the table his package, his plan, and his approach for dealing with Medicare. And if all you want to do is keep repeating the garbage that comes out of the White House, then you've got a problem. Because the American public is going to see that the plan that is being put forward is the plan Mitt Romney has put
forward. So let's read then what comes out of MittRomney.com. It sounds awfully like the Paul Ryan Medicare plan.
But it's very different.
That's John Sununu and Soledad O'Brien. And Soledad O'Brien said no apologies. She's going to be tough with whoever the guest is, and she's not going to let them read talking points. So let's listen to my colleague Michelle Faust talking to Soledad O'Brien about diversity in journalism.
You know, I was actually asked to talk about the legacy of Dr. King, and I think with all these events that have happened really over the last year, including protests and Hollywood talking about lack of diversity, et cetera, what we really wanted to do was take a look as we celebrate in January Martin Luther King Day. You know, where are we since the time has passed since his anniversary of his death? Many years ago now, about 8 years ago, we started a documentary series called Black in America. And it's given us, you know, year after year, a chance to kind of examine the state of the Black community. And so through that lens, I think we take a look at what Dr. King was thinking about, hoping for, and really what has transpired. And so, you know, I think it's a realistic, I'm an optimistic person, so I think it's a hopeful look at what lies ahead, but I think it's an honest assessment of some of the challenges that we have.
The film Selma that just came out really puts a lot of emphasis on how King used the news media to get his message out. Did that resonate with you?
You know what's interesting is, I remember doing an interview with Al Sharpton years and years and years ago now, probably 10 years ago. And Al Sharpton, I was at the Today Show maybe more than 10 years ago. Gosh, it would have been probably 12 years ago. And he was telling me about how he used to be a community organizer for protests, and he obviously worked with Jesse Jackson, worked with Dr. King, and he said, you know, part of our job was to help people who were in power. So, for example, if you had an elected official who really couldn't bring something to the table, you know, a protest would make them be able to say, listen, this is clearly an issue. And so often the news media absolutely was an opportunity to shine a light on a problem that often, you know, would have gone unheard. Really, if you look at some of the visuals from the South, for example, in Birmingham, the dogs, it wasn't until the black media had been covering those conflicts for a long time. It wasn't until the Northern, you know, the New York Times and the white media came into Birmingham, and it really then became a national story. And then the framing of it was, you know, is this injustice, not just what's happening here in Birmingham? And I think that that's really critical.
You know, we were speaking just a few months back about diversity in the media, and your title, it talks about being behind the scenes. We had a speaker from the National Association of Hispanic Journalists who said when the decisions are made behind the scenes, when you've got people at higher levels in media organizations, that that makes a real difference on how people of color are portrayed. I imagine you have an opinion on that.
Well, I think for whether you're talking about race, you're talking about class, you're talking about gender, or you're talking about anything, honestly, anytime you have a seat at the table, you're in a position to frame a conversation. I mean, I think that's why these discussions about who has access and who has a seat at the table are so important, you know, because by the time something is, you know, a day away from being released or reported on, those decisions have all been made. And often the real decision is not what's said, but the real decision is what's covered and whose voice is heard and whose voice is left out. So I think for, you know, what the minority news organizations like NAHJ and NABJ have all really realized a long time ago that they need to be in the conversation way before it gets to, hey, this is airing tomorrow. They need to be in the conversation when you're framing, well, what is the debate and what are the important angles? You know, and I think women have seen the same thing. I remember, gosh, one of the places I worked a million years ago, local news, had was doing a story on non-traditional jobs. You know, and I remember, like, all the women in the newsroom were outraged because a lot of the non-traditional jobs were, you know, leadership jobs. You know, this is a woman who's a boss of this. I mean, it was so ridiculous. And the women, you know, brought the issue forward and said, we shouldn't put this on TV. And I remember thinking that, you know, they came together as a group because they understood, you know, the power of the message you'd be sending if this got on air, and they didn't support it. So I think that, but being able to nip that in the bud or help shape that conversation early is really critical. Doing it, you know, when that ship has sailed is you know, useless.
You're going to be speaking when you come here about King's legacy, and you mentioned that there's resonance today with a lot of the events that just happened in the last year, including Ferguson. And I just wanted you to expand on that.
A lot of reading about Dr. King, and I've done now several documentaries on Dr. King. I think a lot of the debates that were happening during Ferguson were, you know, well, what would Dr. King think of these protesters, especially the protesters who devolved into violence? You know, what would he be against that? Or even some people saying, you know, Dr. King wouldn't support this protest, or Dr. King would say this, or Dr. King would do this, or even Dr. King would be on Twitter, or Dr. King would not be on Twitter. That's a true conversation, by the way. You know, what I realized from the work that I've done is that what Dr. King referred to a lot in many of his speeches were the things that America's built on, the Declaration of Independence, the Constitution. You know, and so his framing is much more than just, I believe in nonviolent protest. It's sort of, that is sort of layered on top of this idea that all men are created equal, right? This idea that we have bought into as a nation. This is our credo. We believe this. All men are created equal. And so he's building the nonviolent protest is sort of a means to the end for him. So he very much understands violence and protest. He doesn't condone it at all, but understands it. And so I think, to me, it's about deconstructing his message and getting to the heart of what he, you know, which is about humanity, right? It's about treating people fairly and justly, like they're human beings who are equal. Like, that's what, you know, the people in the Constitution, the Declaration of Independence, they could have put in, you know, all white men are created equal, or they could have put in all landowning white men are created equal. At that time, that would have been perfectly fine to do. Not a single person would have edited that out, but they didn't. So I think that's a really important distinction, that they understood that they believe all men, and years later, obviously women would have to kind of figure out how to get into that, are created equal and are granted certain rights given to them by their creator, is what the philosophy was. And so on top of that, Dr. King layers this concept of, ergo, we are going to fight for these opportunities. We're going to be against injustice. And that, to me, is what connects Ferguson and the Eric Garner killing and even, you know, unfairness in hiring in Hollywood. I think all those things are connected by that common thread about, well, what is fair and what is just? Because those are the ideals that this nation was built on.
Now, what role does the news media have in getting the story out to create the justice? You have on your Starfish Media Group website the slogan, telling life's untold stories. What is the role of that untold story?
Listen, I think the media's job is to tell stories and to tell them from all sides, and maybe not, you know, certainly our perspective at Starfish Media is to not keep going back to the same voices. You know, one of the things that we wanted to hear when we did, for example, our most recent Black in America, we took a look at stop and frisk in New York City. And so we heard from a kid who's been stopped 100 times, who has no criminal record, who's never been stopped with anything. He's been stopped 100 times. And he talks about how embarrassing it is. He's stopped in front of his school. He goes to college, sometimes being, you know, frisked in front of his professors as they're walking by. And he's like, it's embarrassing. It's humiliating. And then you get angry, you know, because it just happens so often. And at the same token, we talked to an African-American police rookie who talks about, you know, what it's like to walk around some neighborhoods where you're fearful and how he's been stopped and how he doesn't mind being stopped. He's like, if I fit the description, I fit the description. And, you know, as long as I'm treated respectfully, I'm fine with that. I understand the police have their job to do. So often I think both of those voices are unheard. You know, we don't really get the perspective. We talk about statistics. We talk about numbers. Politicians, you know, yammer on. But I really want to hear from the people who are trying to make these decisions every day. And that's what I think the media's responsibility is, to give a microphone occasionally to people who don't necessarily have such a great platform to share their story.
You've experienced quite a bit of success in your career, but I imagine at some point when you were starting out, did you have to fight to tell these untold stories?
You know, I think every journalist has to test. You know, you and I probably could spend 2 hours over a number of cocktails talking about stories that we tried to get on the air. You know, and sometimes it just depends. You know, sometimes you're lucky. Sometimes you hit it right. Sometimes, you know, nobody cares what you're passionate about. So, yeah, I think for everybody, every journalist has a long history of stories that they felt, you know, nobody cared about. When I was starting reporting, you know, women's stories, you know, stories about education were considered to be girl stories. You know, that meant they were in the D block of the newscast. They're just not important. I think now we talk about education as incredibly important, even in a national newscast. Healthcare stories were often B-block stories, a new clinic opening. So, you know, I think that that's actually changed over time. But yeah, I think every journalist fights for the stories that they think are important and relevant, and it forces you, frankly, to become a better articulator of why you think it's important that it airs. You know, puts you in a position of defending your position.
You've made a name for yourself with the documentaries like Black in America, Latino in America, and I wonder, knowing many reporters of color who have maybe shied away from issues of diversity and race because they didn't want to be pigeonholed in there, why did you go and take that path instead of shying away from it like some others?
You know, I just thought it was an interesting story. You know, the only stories that I shy away from are the ones where I don't really get the story, or I think it's not interesting. There's nothing to tell. And I certainly knew, I mean, you know, my mom's Black, my dad's white. I knew there were tons of stories about race and sort of the conflicts around race that were incredibly interesting that no one was really telling. But, you know, but most of the stories, I did documentaries on Muslims in America and gay men having children and serial killers and Jim Jones and, you know, every single project I've ever taken on has really been about, is it interesting to me and is there a story here that I think I can communicate well?
We are airing on our television station, Independent Lens, A Path Appears, and that's really dealing with issues of poverty and class issues. You were involved in that project, and a lot of what the point of this documentary is kind of putting a light on the invisibility in the United States. And I wonder if you could expand on your interest in this topic.
Oh, gosh, you know, I think the thing about poverty, right, is, you know, nobody wants to talk about poverty. Gosh, talk about an issue that really, you know, you feel like you have to stand on a table and shout about because absolutely nobody cares. I mean, I've literally been told, you know, nobody wants to see that. That's a quote I've had bosses tell me, ooh, nobody wants to see that. So I think that the reporter's job, though, is to look at the data and champion stories about stuff that maybe people don't think they want to see because it's important, and it's important to the direction the nation's going. It's important to our values, what we believe. There's tons of reporting now, tons of data on poverty. And it's very interesting. I mean, they just had a report out that half the nation's children now who are in public school are in poverty. You know, there are huge implications of that, huge. So I think that sometimes it feels like an unwinnable fight, you're pitching a poverty story. I know from my experience, and people, roll their eyes, ugh, we don't want to hear that anymore. I've had the same reaction when we pitch a story about HIV/AIDS, in the 80s. Ugh, nobody wants to talk about that. And, I've had certainly people tell me, Black in America, God, haven't you done enough? You've done 8 stories. Isn't that plenty? Or I did a doc on women rescue workers at Ground Zero, and people are like, why do you want to do more on women? Ugh. luckily, I don't, and I'm sure you don't either, listen to other people's feedback. As a reporter, your job is to figure out, is there an interesting story here? And certainly poverty, sadly, is a very interesting story. There's lots of data, lots of research, and lots of compelling personal narratives to get to.
So what are some of the stories that are coming up from Soledad O'Brien that we can look forward to?
Gosh, Starfish Media Group is in the middle of producing a number of docs. Our very first nomination from the Image Award from the NAACP is for a doc I did about veterans of the Iraq and Afghanistan War who go through a program who are dealing with post-traumatic stress. And we are working on a project about women in prison who have their babies in prison and they get to keep their babies behind bars with them. Working on a project about heroin addiction. I'm working on a documentary about people who have been who should have won the Medal of Honor decades ago and were overlooked for many, many years. We finished a project, our Black and Blue documentary, aired on CNN. And, so we're just busy. We're in the middle of a zillion projects, super, super busy. But all of them, I think, are an interesting, look at an issue very much from the character, the character-driven story, but undergirded by real research and real facts about something that, I think we're struggling with as a nation today.
We've been speaking with Soledad O'Brien, the founder of Starfish Media Group. Thank you so much for speaking with us today.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for having me.
That is Soledad O'Brien, and Michelle Faust was, I would think it's fair to say, excited to talk to her. She is certainly a very engaging personality, isn't she?
Engaging, but a lot of work that she's done that I definitely respect. So, it's interesting. It's fun always to speak with someone who's been doing a job that you try to do and in a way that you think that they're exemplifying. So.
And I think it's always valuable to know and be sort of self-aware about the landscape of American newsrooms, for example.
Sure.
It's a really white landscape still, and it's more male-dominated still. That hasn't changed that much over the years. It is not reflective of society. And I think her conversation just makes us, again, remember the value of seeing all perspectives, I guess. What do you think?
Well, I think, obviously, we do this job because we do value all perspectives,
Absolutely.
I mean, that at the end of the day, I think we have a lot to learn from one another, and that's what we're trying to do, is get those stories out there. I was very moved by that slogan that she has, telling the untold story. I just gave a speech about that a couple weeks ago, so it definitely rings true with me.
And one more time for our audience, I want to make sure we thank our IT for helping facilitate this interview, because this is just one of those circumstances where Soledad O'Brien was going to be on the program live a week ago today. That's the day that all the Sheldon Silver stuff broke, and that kind of detonated our plan of coverage that day. And so there isn't a whole lot that would move us off an interview with Soledad O'Brien, let's put it that way, but that did. And they were nice enough to find time for the interview, but she is at RIT right now.
Yeah, she's probably speaking right now. She's right in the middle of her speech. So it's good that our listeners who have to be at work today or have to be doing other things are able to hear this piece of her message.
And by the way, as Michelle said, it's telling the untold story. It's a theme. It's an ethos. And that's kind of the goal next hour, is we talk about a recent poverty simulation. It's one thing to talk about it. It's another to try to experience it. And as we go into our next hour, we're going to tell you about a recent event that allowed people to finally really feel what it's like to try to go through a day in poverty, to feel the doors that are closed and the opportunities that you want to be there that might not be there. So, Michelle, thanks for that interview, and thanks for taking the time for us on Connections.
Thank you, Evan.
And we're going to talk to Michelle tomorrow. She has had a very busy week. Short break, and join us next hour as we talk about poverty on Connections.